Physics World.
Hello, welcome to Physics World Weekly. I'm James Dacey, and coming up, we're looking at the different ways in which physics can help to cut the carbon footprint of the places in which we live, work and play. We'll also be hearing from Mary Archer, the Chair of the Trustees of the National Science Museum, who's speaking about her diverse career in science and industry. As always, I'm joined by our General Physics Editor, Hamish Johnston. He's going to start today by giving us a roundup of some of the stories making the headlines on our website this week.
Hi, James.
Hiya.
We've got a really interesting story this week about citizen science. That's where, sort of your average person gets involved in scientific research these days, normally via the internet. And the headline is Citizen Scientists Excel at Creating Bose-Einstein Condensates. And this describes how members of the public were allowed to control an ultra-cold atom experiment in real time via the internet. The experiment was in Denmark, and citizen scientists tried to chill a cloud of rubidium by manipulating laser beams and a magnetic field that were applied to the atoms. The goal was to create a Bose-Einstein condensate, which can emerge at temperatures of less than 1 degree above absolute zero. The process was turned into a game, and the public were actually able to create larger condensates than the physicists who had built the experiment in the first place. Jacob Schursen at Aarhus University and colleagues also used algorithms to optimize the process. And they're very keen on developing ways of combining human and machine intelligence to solve problems.
So it's been quite a big week, I see, for Bose-Einstein condensates, because you've got another story here about that phenomena.
That's right, yeah. We do have a second news story about Bose-Einstein condensates. We do love Bose-Einstein condensates on Physics World. This is a news item about researchers at the Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information in Austria. And they've created the first ever dipolar quantum mixture in which Bose-Einstein condensates made of two different highly magnetic species of atoms, erbium and dysprosium. The condensates coexist and interact with each other. In the future, the system could be used to study the quantum behavior of ultra-cold gases, such as fermionic superfluids, in more detail, as well as to create novel states of matter that contain many-body quantum states. The research is described in Dipolar Quantum Mixture makes its debut.
We've got something here, an intriguing story involving seabirds and tidal power.
That's right. Yeah, this is an interesting story from the west coast of Wales, and it has to do with birds called razorbills. The headline of the story is "Razorbills Provide Sharp Insight into Ocean Currents." Bit of a pun going on there. But back in 2011, the UK's Royal Society for the Protection of Birds fitted razorbills living on Puffin Island off the coast of Wales with GPS tags to study how they breed and feed. Little did the organization, or indeed the birds, know that the data that was collected would be used 7 years later to provide details about ocean currents that could identify the best sites for generating tidal energy. The initial study showed that at night, the birds spent a lot of time resting on the surface of the sea. Matt Cooper of Bangor University in the UK, or I should say formerly of Bangor University in the UK, said that we saw this as an opportunity to reuse the data and test if the birds might be drifting with the tidal current.
It sounds like something from a kid's cartoon or something, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, yeah.
So finally here, we've got a story then about radiation therapy.
Right. Magnetic resonance, or MR guidance, is emerging as a powerful tool for real-time monitoring of radiation treatments. With hybrid devices for MR-guided photon-based radiotherapy now in clinical use. I should point out that I did a webinar on Friday about this, if you're interested. However, no such combined system exists for proton therapy. Now a team at Onco-Ray Research Lab in Germany has integrated a low-field open MR scanner with a static proton research beam line, and they've shown, at least in principle, that simultaneous proton irradiation and in-beam MRI is technically feasible. You can read more about this in MRI Guidance is Feasible for Proton Therapy. And if you go to the webinar section of Physics World, you can see the webinar that I hosted last week about MR guidance.
We've also had a recent series of videos as well looking at a range of different medical physics techniques. And I know one of those was looking at MR-guided radiation therapy, so proton therapy. So you can see that within the multimedia section of physicsworld.com as well.
So James, you've recently been to a meeting in London all about physics in the built environment. Tell us about that.
That's right, yeah. So this was actually back in mid-October. I'm finally getting a chance to talk about it now. It was the Institute of Physics's Environmental Physics Group. So the Institute of Physics, as we've mentioned a few times on this podcast, is the sister organisation of IOP Publishing, which produces Physics World. So this group organised the event, which was looking at the different ways in which physics can inform the design of urban spaces, urban environments, so basically buildings and other types of infrastructure. And it was a meeting at the IOP's old headquarters in London. It must have been probably one of the last meetings, actually, because they've recently moved.
And what was the purpose of the meeting? What was discussed?
It was very wide ranging. It was, obviously this is an increasingly important theme. This need to live more sustainably, with all the context of climate change and all the emissions targets around carbon dioxide. And I think particularly around that time, October, it was shortly after the latest IPCC report, which was looking at the impact of 1.5-degree warming as compared with the 2-degree target that was set at the 2015 meeting in Paris. But also, I think for the IOP, it's of particular interest because, as I mentioned, they were on the cusp of moving into this new building, which is at
King's Cross, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's a modern building they actually commissioned and helped design. And there's quite a strong focus within the design of that building around the energy performance. For example, I know they incorporated a thermal model of the building itself, and I know it has a passive system and a ground source heat pump rather than central heating. And they're going to have space there to test technologies like solar cells. They're going to have a space on the roof for the latest thin film technology. And also one of the key things the chief executive has been talking about is to think of the building as a bit of a living research space, and lots of the data surrounding this energy performance will be provided to the UK and global physics community for them to analyse.
And what were some of the specific topics that were covered during the meeting? What were the highlights?
It was a real mixture, really. I mean, because we're talking about where people live and lifestyle and workspaces. So naturally, it's interdisciplinary. There are engineering themes, architecture, and obviously social considerations as well. The opening speech actually was quite provocative. It was a guy at University of Bath called David Coley, and he's a researcher in low carbon design. And his talk had the provocative title of "Are Buildings Evil?" One of his key messages is that basically we need to, when considering beauty in architecture, we should take account of the impact it's doing to the environment. So the carbon footprint should be something that architects have right at the forefront of their design. And he's even invented a new word, which I don't know how you say this, but I think it's defornicare, which he defined as meaning ugly through harm. So it's he wants to really kind of shift the conversation around what constitutes a successful building among architects.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, one thing that I've noticed recently is, you know, a lot of new buildings tend to have huge atrium, like a huge atrium open space. Mm. Even schools these days have a huge atrium. And the Canadian in me takes a look at this huge open space and thinks, I don't want to pay the heating bills for that. I mean, is that the sort of thing that he's talking about? That maybe we love these huge open spaces within buildings, but maybe they're not so practical in terms of energy use, or maybe they are practical in terms of energy use. I don't know.
I mean, that was the kind of thing he was talking about. I mean, he did mention schools, and he said that, you know, even though we've modernized buildings in many different ways, the actual efficiency hasn't really improved that much over the years. And he took particular issue with big glass spaces, which, you know, during the winter, lots of heat escapes. And then during the summer, you can have too much overheating, which requires aircon. So he was talking about in terms of sort of practical solutions. I mean, he mentioned, you know, if you've got the luxury to have a sort of passive house concept, so if you can, you know, if you can design buildings that can circulate the heat in clever ways. But he did say there's perhaps simpler things you can do. And he looked at the example of, say, a school that has a gym attached to the edge of it. And, you know, gyms are often quite big spaces with high ceilings that get very, very cold in the winter and need warming. So he suggested, you know, if you had an IT server room, why not place it alongside that, or alongside a corridor space where this heat that would have been wasted will come back into the building.
But do people really want to work in buildings that don't have large windows? Mm. So it's here at IOP Publishing in Bristol. We have these fantastic, huge windows. And just the other day, we had lovely views of rainbows and things like that. I mean, people must love big windows if designers don't love them for energy reasons.
I think that's probably the one criticism I would have of the talk is that David Coley didn't really seem to engage with the other reasons why you might want an open space. You know, there's probably loads of reasons why, if you're looking at a school or, you know, a modern business or some kind of public building, why you would want to create a sense of openness as opposed to, you know, having dark, shady corridors and that sort of thing. So I got the impression he seemed like he'd had lots and lots of meetings over the years with architects, and he was probably just fed up of, you know, seeing the latest blueprint that was the latest big, massive greenhouse in central London. And it feels like it was a bit of a reaction to just the extent of glass that he's seeing around the place.
And at the other end of the scale, there's also a talk by some researchers from Loughborough University about the housing in the UK.
Yeah, so this was looking at data, basically. It was two researchers, so Matt Lee and David Allenson at Loughborough University. So they're interested in the thermal performance of building, and in particular, the UK housing stock. And so they're basically quite excited with the advent of smart meters and the Internet of Things, so improvements in terms of connected sensors, etc., that you can now install into buildings. And they're looking to develop better ways of assessing the thermal performance of buildings.
And so what could change with all this data?
Well, they started by looking at how things are done now. So typically, when, you know, up until this point, when people assess the performance of a building, they use this thing known as the heat transfer coefficient, which essentially is defined as the heat flow rate from inside to outside divided by the difference between the temperature indoors and outdoors. So it's essentially looking at a building's ability to warm up and then keep the temperature without losing it to the outside world. But they pointed out that quite often in these tests, it's taken as a steady state system where when they do it, people have to leave the house for up to 3 weeks at a time. And also the accuracy in the end is only certain to an accuracy of plus or minus 10%. So basically it's highly impractical in lots of cases and not even that accurate. So they're looking at developing ways of taking improved data from sensing of installed within materials and looking at houses when people are actually living in them. So looking at energy usage, which can now be more easily identified using smart meters. And so developing more dynamic models that can give you a more accurate view of how a house behaves. So I caught up with Matt Lee after the talk, and this is what he had to say.
With the smart meter rollout, we're going to have half hourly electricity and gas consumption data in homes across the UK. And so the question is, can we harness that data to get an idea of building thermal performance? If we know how much energy is being used to heat a home, then whereas before we could only do quite intrusive tests on single dwellings, we have the potential to measure homes across the country and get a real picture of how the whole UK domestic stock is performing. And if we can do this dynamically, if we can do that on a regular basis using data that's just being collected all the time through smart meters, we can think about doing tests not only just when the building is initially completed, but also when it has a refurbishment, if it has double glazing put in, if it has a new boiler. We can do a test before and after and say, has that actually improved the performance of the building? So people can start to think about, instead of just buying a physical improvement to the house and not knowing what it really does, perhaps it could be sold to them on the basis of a promise that it will improve their performance by a certain number of watts per degree of heat that they have in the dwelling.
So will that give people the opportunity to actually challenge, for example, people who are offering services for refurbishment, to actually sort of putting hard data on something rather than just relying on the marketing from that company?
Yeah, that's the hope. We don't want to come at it as an angle of saying that that technology providers and building companies are dishonest. It's we want to work together with industry and to allow them to provide a better service, to give people a better idea of exactly what they're buying.
So basically this data that we're going to be getting more and more of can be used by designers, engineers and individuals as well.
Yeah, that's the hope. I'm not sure what the exact figures are, but I know the smart meter rollout is coming at quite great expense, and there's a lot of calls for justification of that expense. The way I see it is that at the moment, if we're just measuring gas consumption and electricity, we might want to think about putting in a more full array of sensing equipment to measure things like humidity and indoor air quality. And in order to get policy approval to do that, there needs to be existing evidence that this initial wave of smart metering has been beneficial.
Okay, well, good luck with your data revolution.
Thank you very much.
So Hamish, you were also in London recently at the Science Museum, where among the people you met was Mary Archer, who's the chair of the Board of Trustees there. Is that right?
Yeah, I met Mary Archer. She's, she used to be a chemist. She started out, she's had a very interesting career, which is what I spoke to her about. She did chemistry at Oxford, and she did a PhD in catalysis at Imperial College. And then she went on to have a very successful 10-year career as an academic chemist. But then in the mid-1980s, she started to move away from academia, and notably, she started getting involved in the NHS, the UK's National Health Service. In 1992, she was appointed chair of the Cambridge University Hospitals NHS Trust. And she was there for a good 10 years. And she was honored by the Queen. She was made Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire for her services to the NHS. And that was in 2012. Since then, she's joined the Science Museum, where she is a chair of the Board of Trustees. And we sat down in her office at the Science Museum in South Kensington, and we started talking about her early days as a chemist, where she worked in solar energy, and in particular, some of her efforts in getting solar energy on the map, let's say, in the UK. We also spoke about her switch to the NHS, and finally, about how to get women, or more women, interested in doing science.
Okay, should we hear what she had to say then?
Yep.
So, Mary, I'm here today for the opening of the Sun exhibition. Can you tell us a little bit about the Sun exhibition and how you were involved in organizing it?
Thanks. Hamish, lovely that you could come along today. So The Sun, Living with Our Star, is the Science Museum's latest exhibition, wonderful exhibition, showing the importance of the sun to us throughout the ages, from the Bronze Age right up to the present day. So the culture of the sun, the therapeutic effects of sunlight, and solar energy utilization, which is something that's very dear to my own heart, because that's what I used to work on in my days as a research chemist. So we've got some wonderful things in the exhibition, all the way from ancient means of telling the time via the sun. Of course, the sun gives us our time, right through to a tokamak made by Tokamak Energy, an attempt to recreate nuclear fusion here on Earth as a source of energy. I think it's going to be a very popular exhibition. Certainly, it's going to tour for a long time when it's been here at the Science Museum.
You're a pioneer in solar energy, but I suppose you haven't worked in it for a while. But how would you characterize the technology that we have today? Is it a mature technology, or is there still a lot of work to be done on solar energy?
I think that there are various ways of using solar energy that are at different states of maturity. When I started research on it way back in the 70s, everything was pretty immature. But since then, photovoltaics has really forged ahead. So these, of course, are direct conversion devices, usually made of silicon, but not invariably PN junction devices that convert light above a certain threshold wavelength, or rather below a certain threshold wavelength, above a certain threshold energy, into electric power. And way back when I started, they were regarded, photovoltaics, as, well, they were just in space to power satellites. And they've come down to Earth and really been commoditized, largely, I have to say, because of the huge production facilities that there are in China and the Far East now that are turning out solar panels, solar modules, much more cheaply. So that, I would say, is a pretty mature technology, and the advances there are more in making PV integrate better with the built environment and our lives. And also the Achilles heel of many solar technologies: what do you do when the sun doesn't shine? And in that case, you probably need battery storage, and that has implications about efficiency and longevity of batteries, which are also improving, of course. Solar thermal, there are a number of large-scale experiments, particularly in southern Europe and in California. This is really raising steam, ultimately, and driving a turbine, so it's solar electricity. that struggles, I think, for financial viability, though technically it works. And equally, the very high temperatures that are achieved by having a field of so-called heliostats, mirrors that point at the sun and reflect direct sunlight onto a central tower, generating very high temperatures. That is a possible way of using highly concentrated solar and the high temperatures it generates to do useful thermochemical reactions like split water, so make hydrogen as a fuel, or other high-temperature thermochemical processes can be stimulated. So that's at the demonstration stage. There's a lot of work done on that in southern Spain, among other places. But the area that I was working on, which is direct low-temperature fuel production from unconcentrated solar energy, is still really in the lab. So I was lucky when I started my postdoctoral research career. Well, I was lucky in two ways, really. Firstly, that I was accepted by George Porter, who was then director of the Royal Institution, to work with his group. And secondly, that the year was then 1972, and we were just about to have the great oil price hike of, was it 73, which quadrupled the price of oil and stimulated the creation of sort of energy storage and energy self-sufficiency anxieties, and creation of Project Sunshine in Japan, the Solar Energy Research Laboratory in the States, and here in the UK, the Energy Technology Support Unit. Suddenly there was interest in solar and renewables. Hey, oil may be get too expensive for us and it's too politically uncertain. And so George, of course, was a great photochemist. I was an electrochemist at that stage. So I became a photoelectrochemist, interested in the action of light on electrochemical systems. And at the RI, I worked on a device called a photogalvanic cell, which is where sunlight drives a reaction in solution or solid state, usually a redox reaction, to create high energy intermediates, which if you can capture at electrodes, selective electrodes, you can make the reaction run back and generate electric power. So it's like a wet version of a photovoltaic cell, if I can put it like that way, but there's a lot of chemistry actually occurring. So they turned out to be rather inefficient devices simply because the high energy redox, photoredox properties products are too short-lived to diffuse to the electrodes and do what they're supposed to do. But that got me very interested in the whole subject of solar energy conversion. So that field has gone on. It's now possible to build an efficient water-splitting photoelectrochemical device. It's possible also to build a device that will do that tough thing, reductively fix carbon dioxide to make a hydrocarbon-like fuel, generally a one or two carbon molecule. But those are still very much laboratory scale experiments because the devices generally have to be chemically and physically rather sophisticated. They may have buried junctions, photovoltaic junctions somewhere in there, and they wouldn't compete. They tend to be relatively short-lived, by which I mean sort of weeks and years rather than the decades you really want for a capital intensive thing like solar energy utilization, where you've got to put all your capital in up front and then you get your payback over the years. And then the other thing about using unconcentrated solar is you've really got to have something really cheap if you're going to, as it were, spread out over a large area. Now, photovoltaics has more or less got there and achieved grid parity in a number of countries. But these more complex, sort of more chemically based systems, unless it's something as simple as a pond with a smart kind of perhaps genetically engineered alga in it, you're struggling on economic viability. So, long answer to a short question. Some solar technologies are mature, some are maturing, some may never mature. But I think what is for sure is that solar and renewables more generally, which of course usually solar driven, like the wind and water, hydropower, are here to stay and will form an increasing part of the world's fuel mix. PV, when I started work, the UK dismissed PV as not for the UK, and
that's photovoltaics.
Yeah, photovoltaics.
I'm guessing because of the lack of sunshine.
Lack of sunshine. Yes, that's right. And it was a very small global market, very small. Now it's over 100 gigawatts a year.
Because I think when you were at the Royal Institution, you founded or helped found an organization devoted to solar energy research. What was the mood like? How was that received by the powers to be at the time?
It was favorably received. So that arose because George sent me to a UNESCO conference in Paris in, I think it was 1973, called The Sun in the Service of Mankind. And I discovered there was an international solar energy society with chapters or sections in quite a number of countries, but not the UK. So I went back to the RI and contacted the other people from the UK who were at that conference and said we should have a UK section. And so we formed that, the UK section of the International Solar Energy Society at the Royal Institution. George helped launch it. It's still going. It promotes, awareness of solar energy, and it's part in our lives.
At some point in your career, I think you made the decision that you were going to leave academic research and start working with the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK. What was the thinking behind that? Why did you make that decision?
Well, I was coming up to 10 years teaching at Cambridge chemistry, which was great, and actually it taught me all the chemistry, really, that I know, more than my undergraduate career. But it was 10 years, it was the longest I'd ever been in one job, and I've always been interested in making things happen. Not without a lot of soul-searching, I decided to resign my academic fellowship and take myself out of full-time academia, though I've never sort of completely left it in my heart, and use my skills in the real world, as academics tend to think there's a real world out there. Of course, I soon discovered there's no one real world. There's lots of other specialised worlds. And I was very fortunate because I was teaching for Trinity College, Cambridge at the time, and the former bursar of Trinity College, the late Sir John Bradfield, had stepped down as bursar, very successful bursar of the college, and become chairman of the newly formed NHS Hospital Trust for Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge. So he invited me to become a non-executive director on that new trust, which I did. And I did a number of other things in a kind of a bit of a portfolio phase of my career. But I went on, as it were, in Addenbrookes. I became vice chairman, then I became chairman of what is now called Cambridge University Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. So I got into the NHS sort of a little bit by accident, or it was just a turn that my career could take because I decided to open myself up to the opportunity of doing something different. And I think it was wonderful, actually. I'm a big fan of the NHS. It saved my life and countless others' lives. And what I discovered was that my scientific training actually exported pretty well. A big hospital like CUH has a big research hinterland, and so that was useful. But, of course, it was a new world for me, and I had to learn a lot about corporate governance and so forth. But for me, that was the right move.
And you say your skills transferred. Is that the skills that you developed managing a research group, or the actual scientific skills, or a bit of both?
I think it's not so much scientific skills as the scientific way of thinking. So that is to say, respect for evidence rather than opinion, accuracy, numeracy, and that kind of honesty that comes from being a scientist. You know, you can't. It's hard to be a scientific fraudster because you tend to get found out. Those, I think, are transferable skills that I found helpful. Less helpful are the scientist's tendency to want to get to know every last sort of thing about one particular problem. I always feel when I was a research scientist, I was down a mine, very exciting mine, sort of finding little seams of gold and silver here and there. But then when you come out into a job like being chairman of a big hospital or chairman of the Science Museum Group, as I am now, it's like sort of coming out into the open and you see a whole sort of sunlit field of wonderful things around you. And you can't really get to the bottom of them all. And that's something you have to unlearn a bit from your scientific days. You've got to rely much more on other people knowing detail that you can't know.
Do you have any thoughts on why physics and engineering are particularly difficult, mm. to get more women into those subjects? I mean, I think biology and chemistry are
much better populated. Yes. Well, I think there's something, of course, necessarily abstract about maths, which is the underpinning, as it were, science for, well, underpinning discipline for physics in particular. Engineering, of course, is not a school subject. One thing I would say about girls, this is a generalization and no doubt I'll be shot down in flames, but girls like to know they can be successful at something. So if you haven't met engineering in your formative years, you may not think you'll be a success at it. Whereas boys seem to me to take more risks and say, yes, I could do that. So that's one thing. Another is that physics teaching, and to a lesser extent chemistry teaching, has not in the past been good at engaging with what it does in real life. We're better at that now, so a good physics teacher will be easily able to relate physics to things that are all around them, from LED lights to the World Wide Web. And the same is true of chemistry. So I think it's relating the utility of what one is asked to study to the world around us and improving it that helps girls and boys see why are they learning this periodic table. Why is the third law of thermodynamics important?
Well, that's great, Mary. Thanks for speaking to me.
Thanks for coming along, Hamish, to our opening of the Exhibition of the Sun, and great to talk to you.
Okay, thanks, Hamish, for that really good interview. And thank you for joining us today. And don't forget, you can keep up to date with all the latest research breakthroughs by visiting our website.
And there's something special today. I've put up the top 5 breakthroughs in general physics. I know that sounds a bit complicated, but that is going up onto the website today. It'll be there
as you are listening to this. It is my pick for the five most important research stories in physics this year, and my colleagues who work elsewhere on the website will also be publishing their top fives over the next few days, and that will culminate in the announcement next week of the top 10 breakthroughs in physics, as well as the number one. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Thanks.
Physics World.